Welcome to the podcast of First Presbyterian Church of Marietta, where we are committed to changing lives with faith, hope, and love. We're so glad you are here.
All right, so welcome back to our intertestamental literature class, or Second Temple Judaism class, from Alexander the Great to Jesus Christ. We're almost at Jesus. We're almost there. We're very close. So today in the syllabus, it's testamentary literature, or the literature about the testaments. Now, not Old Testament, New Testament. This is about last will and testaments, actually. So we'll get to that in a little bit. But also, we're talk about the rise of Herod. I'll segue from some of our testamentary literature into Herod himself and the story of where Herod comes from, which is really interesting, or at least to me, but also sets up our segue to Rome and the function of Rome and the Roman Empire in Judea at the time of Jesus. So next week we'll talk about wisdom literature, a little bit of a detour. We'll talk about the wisdom of Solomon and Philo of Alexandria. The whole point being this helps us to understand how biblical interpretation worked at the time of Jesus and at the time of Paul, to help us understand more of how the New Testament works. But then 2 weeks from now, our last week of this semester, we'll take a little break for Christmas time and the new year. But the last week of this semester, we'll talk about the rise of Rome. We'll actually talk about just Rome in general, like where does, when did Rome become a big city, and so on. And a little bit of the history of the Roman Republic, and then the transition to the Roman Empire, all of which actually has to do, well, not all of which, but a lot of which has to do with Judea, believe it or not. That is to say that Judea and Jerusalem actually figured into the story of Rome several times. And we'll hear a little bit about that today. So in any event, we are coming around the bend in our semester and in terms of history to an era that is probably a little bit more familiar. So remember, we're moving from the Old Testament to the New Testament period here and trying to bridge the gap a bit. So about testamentary literature. Way back at the beginning of the semester, we were talking about the 3rd century BCE, the 3rd century before Jesus, 3rd century being at this time of transition from Persian rule, and before that Babylonian rule, before that Assyrian rule, all ancient Near Eastern peoples, the transition to Greek rule, which was a very different kind of cultural, linguistic, economic system. And some of those big changes in the 3rd century BC. Also, we begin to see some Greco-Roman literary forms that begin to emerge in Jewish literature. One of these forms that has both an ancestry and kind of a heritage in the ancient Israelite tradition, but also is heavily influenced by Greco-Roman tradition, is what we call testamentary literature, or testaments, the testaments of. So on the Jewish side, we can see some of these kind of last will and testament things inside larger biblical books. They kind of, these transition points in the biblical narrative, oftentimes what will happen is a character, a significant character like Jacob, when he's dying, will give a last speech. If anyone remembers those kind of strange blessings that Jacob gives near the end of Genesis, Jacob blesses all 12 of his children and gives them these kind of prophecies almost. They often have to do with seeing into the future a bit. That's at least the Jewish heritage, the Jewish side of the testamentary literature. There's something to do with like foretelling the future. Not clearly usually in poetic form or sometimes very vaguely. But there is this notion that it's trying to push people into the future. And oftentimes it has to do with some ethics and morals, right? Try to live right. And there's a religious side to this, too. That is, they often say, follow the covenant or follow God. And there's oftentimes some admonitions to people who don't follow. So in any event, we can see even in Genesis, Jacob, when he dies, gives advice and blessings to his children, to each of his children. And we also can see this with Moses. When Moses dies, he gives a last will and testament. And this is the book of Deuteronomy. That's what it is. So Deuteronomy is the second giving of the law. But more importantly, it's actually Moses on the edge of the promised land when he's about to die. Remember, he's not allowed to come in. And he gives his last speech. He's trying to exhort and teach the Israelites so that when they go in and take the land, they remember. They remember the covenant. They remember to follow the precepts of God. They remember their own story. So Deuteronomy starts with a recapitulation of the story of Israel. It doesn't go all the way back, but he tries to remind them of who they are and where they came from because this is the new generation. They might forget. And then he tells them to write it all down and keep reading this thing over and over again. So that we can see at the very end, especially the last few chapters of Deuteronomy, really like 29 through 32, there's this, and 33, there's this like a, Moses sings some songs, he gives some final exhortations. You can see this is really him signing off, but also trying to do so in a way that
leaves a lasting memory and helps the Israelites on their way. We can also see this with Joshua. So the very end of the book of Joshua, Joshua chapters 23 and 24, but mainly 24, comprise really like a last will and testament of Joshua. He gives the story, recapitulates the whole story of ancient Israel, goes all the way back to Abraham and Sarah, and retells the story and tries to tell them this is a covenantal story, so you got to join in the covenant, or you cannot. This is, you know, the famous quote that's in some people's homes, you know, as for me, my home, I will serve the Lord. This comes from Joshua 24. And then you can see the kind of like the preaching side of this, right? It's trying to get people to do something, right? Make a commitment with their lives. So you use the ideas, you're using your last moments on earth to try to push people forward. David did this too. That really amazing speech in 1 Kings 2, when David is dying and he tells his son Solomon, follow the Lord with all your heart. Don't depart from the law. And then David kind of looks around and winks and says to Solomon, by the way, there's some guys who really tried to mess me over during my life here. Don't let them go to the grave in peace, if you know what I'm saying. Not kidding. Take a look at that last speech that David gives to Solomon. So 1 Kings 1 to 2 is really the death of David. And he gives this kind of amazing advice. Very David to say both those things at the same time. So in any event, we can also see this in the New Testament. This kind of last will and testament thing is also appears in the Gospels. And the clearest form is in the end of John. That is to say, John 14 through 17, the Last Supper. In the Gospel of John especially, I mean, Jesus kind of speaks to them at this last meal in all of the Gospels. But in John, he gives really long speeches that are clearly about his own death and about what his disciples are supposed to do afterwards. So just to say, this comes from a deep, long tradition within Judaism, but it's also a tradition within Greco-Roman literature. And there's a slightly different aspect that comes from Greco-Roman literature. They're often very short in Greco-Roman literature, but there's often this kind of exhortation. It's more of a moral exhortation, you know, be great, seize the day, things like this within Greco-Roman literature. But it is a very important part of this of this culture. So in the intertestamental period, or in the period of the Second Temple, in the Hellenistic era especially, Jews begin to kind of combine some of these different elements of Greco-Roman and Jewish literature, and they produce these really interesting pieces of literature that some people have treated as scriptural. I'll mention a couple of these people. Even some of them have been incredibly influential in Christian history. Paul quotes some of these things in the New Testament several times. And in fact, some of them show up in the Gospels. And James seems to cite one of these, the Testament of Job. These were incredibly popular all throughout the Middle Ages, even. If not in scriptural form, that is, people didn't have the texts, the stories, like these kind of created stories that lingered in popular culture all throughout the Middle Ages. And even in the 5th century, there was Pope Gelasius I had to tell people that the Testament of Job, one of these testamentary literature things from the Hellenistic era, that it was not scripture. Put it away. Like, stop reading this instead of the book of Job. So I don't know if you've ever tried to read Job, but it's not easy to read. First of all, it's long. It's really long. It's all poetry. Not all. There's almost all of it is poetry. And it's difficult poetry. It's kind of hard to actually understand what they're saying. It's beautiful poetry. But like every beautiful poem, most people don't read it. So, you know, like William Shakespeare, right? Most people actually don't read the plays because they're long and hard to read, right? They're hard to understand. So the book of Job is kind of like Shakespeare. It's beautiful. It's amazing. It's deep. It's rich. It's also hard to understand. Even from the moment it was written, I think it was supposed to sound a bit archaic and obscure. So there was kind of a easier. So somebody read Job, said, wow, this is really profound. Also, I don't like that Job is so mad all the time. And the devil character is in chapters 1 and 2, but disappears and doesn't come back at the end of the story and so on. So somebody during the Greco-Roman period, somebody probably in the 1st century BC, right around the time of, say, King Herod, was reading the book of Job and thought, I'm going to do better than this. And what they did was they produced the Testament of Job. So this became, again, much more popular than the book of Job for hundreds of years, especially in the Christian community. In the Jewish community, the book of Job, the biblical book of Job, was more popular. But in the Christian community, and you might have even seen some paintings of Job, I'll show you some in a little bit, or pictures of Job that have elements that aren't in the book of Job, that come from even the early modern period. So Albrecht Dürer, I'll show you a painting of his in a little bit, painted the book of Job several times, and he's always including the stuff that you can't find in the book of Job, but it's from the Testament of Job. So all to say that this was a hugely influential part of the Christian tradition, at least, even though it was produced before Christianity existed in the Jewish tradition. So let me just tell you a little bit of how these testaments work. And by the way, the first one of these, the earliest one, we think is called the Aramaic Levi document. Parts of it are missing, the parts at the beginning and the end that would make it clear that it was a last will and testament, but it seems to be one of these things. It comes from the 3rd century BC, so pretty early on in the Greco-Roman tradition in Judea. But it's Levi, like the son of Jacob Levi, who's one of the 12 tribes, who's giving kind of a last will and testament to his children. It's broken, and parts of the text are missing. The Testament of Job we have really only in like several different versions that come from the Middle Ages, but we think that they're as ancient because of some of the way it's written. We think at least some of these go back, at least parts of it go back to the time of, say, Herod the Great. Okay, so chapter 1, Testament of Job. So it begins with the frame story. On the day when Job fell ill and wanted to settle his affairs, again, these are last will and testaments, he called his 7 sons and 3 daughters, whose names were Tersi, Koros, Hyan, Nike, Foros, on Nike, right? Pife, Cryon, Hermera, Cassia, and Amalthea's horn. Okay, so these are like Job's kids, right? So in the book of Job, Job has 10 children who die in the very first chapter, right? And then he has other children that are born to him later. So these must be his replacement children. We do hear some of the names of these children in the end. Only the 3 daughters actually are named in the book of Job. We'll come back to Job's daughters in just a minute. But Amalthea's horn is one of these names that gets kind of translated from Hebrew into Greek and so on. But anyway, so the sons get names here too. He called his 10 children and said, "Gather around me, my children, and I will tell you all that happened to me and what the Lord did for me. For I am your father Job, who exhibits great endurance, and you are a chosen and honored race from the seed of Jacob, your mother's father. I am from the sons of Esau, and the brother of Nereus. Your mother is Dinah, like Dinah from Genesis, with whom I begot you. My first wife died, however, along with 10 other children in a tragic death." That's actually not from the book of Job. Job's wife is just not mentioned for the rest of the Job after chapter 2. But in any event, here, I guess she died and he got a new wife. "Listen now, children, I will tell you all the things that happened to me. My name was Jobab before the Lord renamed me Job." All right, a couple of things here. This should sound kind of strange. I mean, the book of Job doesn't mention Dinah anywhere. It doesn't mention Jobab. His name's just Job. What's happening here is that what we can see the beginning of really scriptural interpretation. That is to say, some of these early intertestamental books show us somebody is sitting down and trying really hard to make scripture work. So somebody has been reading the book of Job. And the beginning of the book of Job is, there was once a man named Job. He lived in the land of Uz. So where is Uz? We actually don't know. It's mentioned in the Bible a couple times, really only in Genesis as a place. It seems to be like in the middle of nowhere, like Arabian desert somewhere. But then Job is supposed to be this like guy who's like a really powerful king. So the question is, you can see that there were Jews at this time who are thinking, okay, so who really was Job? When did he actually live? Where did he actually live? And there's this name, this guy, Jobab, is mentioned in the book of Genesis, and he's kind of a throwaway character, but he seems to be kind of like related to the family of Esau, which is related again to the family of Jacob in Genesis. Part of this kind of like, it's just one name in a long list of names in the book of Genesis. But Jobab sounds like Job, doesn't it? Ah, so we found Job. He just kind of shortened his name. It's like, William, Billy, Jobab, Job. The problem is this doesn't make any sense in Hebrew. Job in Hebrew is Eyov, and Jobab is Yovav. Totally different names. You cannot get from one to the other. It's like saying Michael and, Ariel are like the same name or something like that. But if you change them both into Greek, then they sound very similar. So only in translation do these things work. So this tells us that Jews this time are reading primarily in Greek. They're primarily doing biblical interpretation in Greek. And this is also what we expect to find with Paul. So Paul is doing these same things. He's reading the Bible in Greek primarily in Septuagint form. That is to say, he's a Palestinian Jew, Paul, originally at least. Eventually travels all over. But this translation that I was telling you about from Alexandria, Egypt, ends up becoming the primary base text for many learned Jews. Now, this will change over time. I'll explain more in the spring semester about kind of the recovery of the Hebrew tradition with the rabbinic Judaism. But here we can see that for some, at least, some learned Jews who are very interested in the Bible, Greek is becoming the primary text, and they've lost some of their Hebrew interpretive skills. This is also true for like how Hebrew poetry works. I don't know if you've read the Psalms, but usually like one line happens and then the next line repeats it in a slightly different way. This is called parallelism. But by the time in the New Testament, learned Jews have actually forgotten how their poetry works. So if you've ever read the New Testament and thought it was kind of strange that Jesus rides both a colt and a donkey into Jerusalem, this is because it's a parallel poem where both lines are supposed to mean the same thing, a foal and a colt, donkey, a colt, that these things are kind of seen as parallel in the book of Zechariah, but they're taken as a prelude to the Messiah. And so then, well, the New Testament writers are thinking, gosh, he's got to ride both these things in at the same time. So Jesus is like straddling two, right? But they've just forgotten a bit about how Hebrew works and how Hebrew poetry works. All to say, we're starting to see this kind of the Greco-Roman culture, and especially the interpretive culture, is starting to kind of bleed in a little bit to Jewish literature and in the Bible. So this is one of the bridges we have to take from the Old Testament to the New Testament, because Paul and the other writers of the New Testament are firmly steeped now in these interpretive traditions, which really arise in Alexandria, Egypt, as part of the kind of learned community there, part of the Library of Alexandria. So, all to say, there's lots more we'll talk about in the New Testament next semester when we talk about the New Testament there. But just this kind of this interpretive tradition, you can see, is also akin to the Jewish practice of Midrash. That is to say, you take these little stories and you kind of like try to figure out how they work, or try to combine biblical stories and see if you can find other nuances there, or try to like just expand some details and come up with some interesting stories. So we'll talk about more about how Midrash works in the spring as well when we talk about Paul. So Paul does this same kind of interpretive work. That is to say, Paul is a Pharisee. The Pharisees are the later rabbis. Paul is following in some of these same interpretive traditions that are infused also by textual practices from the Greco-Roman culture. So we'll talk more next week about Philo of Alexandria and the allegorical tradition. So if you've ever read some early Christian literature and these people are going off in crazy directions, like Origen is like reading the Gospels and like coming up with all sorts of crazy allegories, this is a Greco-Roman interpretive practice that was very popular even at the time of Jesus. So anyway, okay, so the author of this testament wants to figure out who really Job was and try to find the kind of clues in other biblical books. But we continue with the story. So God then appears to Job, this very wealthy guy who lives in the middle of nowhere, and God says, "Get up, and I will show you who this is whom you wish to know. The one to whom they bear whole burnt offerings and to whom they make their libations is not God, but the power of the devil which leads human nature astray." Whole point is, Job is living in this land, and somebody builds a temple. And Job thinks, oh, is that a temple to God? And God says, no, it's a temple to the devil. So again, we've moved to the point of the story of Job opens with this figure of the Satan. I say the Satan, and I don't say Satan with a capital S. If you open up your NRSV and you see, it'll say Satan with a capital S, because that's what every Christian reader wants to see there. But then they'll have a little translational note, and it'll go down to the bottom of the page, and it'll say the Satan. Satan means the accuser, the district attorney. This is the name for like a prosecuting attorney. It's not the name in ancient Hebrew. This is not a word that means the evil one. So I've got proof for this. The story of Balaam, there's an angel that's sent by God that's doing God's work, that holds this flaming sword in the book of Numbers, right, and waves it at Balaam. And Balaam's riding the donkey, and the donkey sees the sword and the angel and stops. And Balaam doesn't. So Balaam's like, come on, you stupid donkey. And of course, the joke, even in ancient Israelite literature, is that Balaam is more of an ass than his ass, right? That's the joke. So Balaam's ass, right? Balaam, in any event, the angel that's doing God's work, that is waving the sword, is called Hasatan, the accuser. It's an accusing angel. It's an angel that comes down to earth in order to accuse people for God, because God wants to accuse those people. That is to say, it's working for God. It's not the evil one. So in the book of Job, we've got all the angels, including the Satan, that arrive, and they talk to God. And the Satan says, hey, did you check into this guy Job? He looks too perfect on the outside. What did you think about his inside? And God says, well, why don't you check it out? That is to say, if you read it one way, they're not like, God doesn't say, you evil creature or something like that. You know, it's the district attorney from heaven. I got more proof that this is the case, that the book isn't actually a fight between the devil and God. And that's that the rest of the book, this character doesn't appear. It's just a way to get into the story. And God takes credit for all the bad things that happened to Job. Even in chapters 1 and 2, God says, I did this. Like, did I do this for nothing? Or, you know, whatever. So that is to say, this figure is kind of prompting God to take action. And it's not right. That is to say, God, Job actually does have integrity. But this divine figure is like, you know, basically it's like, it's an overzealous DA, if that makes sense. That's the whole point of it, right? But it's not evil yet. So by the time of the Greco-Roman period, especially after the time of the Seleucid persecution of Antiochus IV, the persecution of the Jewish people, they've revisited their ancient scriptures, and they've said, this isn't God. God didn't do this. And this is bigger than a person. So what did this? What's responsible for this persecution of the Jewish people? And the result was, well, it's got to be an evil power. So they went back through their scriptures, and they said, where do we see evil powers? And they said, this Hasatan figure. Even if it doesn't work quite right, this was something that existed that stands in the way of people and confronts people in a way that's negative, at least negative to the people. Also, Beelzebub. This just means Lord of the Flies. It's a joke in 2 Kings chapter 1. It's a joke about Baal, the storm god of ancient Canaan. Baal just means Lord. His real name is Lord Hadad, Baal Hadad, but the Bible leaves the Hadad part out because they don't want to say his name. So they just call him Lord, but it's bad Lord, right? So anyway, Baal, the storm god in 2 Kings 1, is called Beelzebul, Lord of the Flies, like Lord of nothing, Lord of ridiculousness, right? This is a joke because he was sometimes called Lord of All. So the Beelzebul, Lord of the Flies, and Lord of All sound alike in Hebrew. So all the same, they revisit this literature and they're like, well, that could be a name for this evil thing. Satan, Lucifer. Lucifer is like a way of saying the day star, son of dawn. They revisited Isaiah chapter 14, which is about the king of Babylon. It's a taunt song against the king of Babylon that he's going to fall someday. He thought he was an angel. He thought he was like divinely powerful, but he actually ended up falling, right? So that is the it's about hubris, really. The king of Babylon thought he was too big for his britches, got too big for his britches, and then fell. And now he's being judged by God. That's at least what Isaiah 14 seems to have been about when it was written. Christians and Jews go back to this literature and are looking through and they say, wow, this actually explains what we think is going on with this divine power of evil. Like, did God create the evil power? No, probably not. Maybe God created a good power that then became evil, got corrupted. That is to say, the story of the king of Babylon seems to be helpful for thinking about how this evil power must have come about. So all to say, Jews and Christians are going back through this literature and rereading it, even before the time of Christianity. That is to say, there's already been this shift to talking about the devil, the evil one, the full power of evil. This is a theological change. But now they're revisiting these stories like Job and now finding evil, fully evil characters in them. If you notice in the Old Testament, God sends the evil spirits or the bad spirits. Like 1 Kings 22, God sends bad spirits to judge people. Evil spirits, even, they're called. It's because in the Old Testament, they're trying to move towards monotheism. They don't want you to worship evil spirits because demons get worshipped in the ancient world. Everyone worships demons in order to make them go away. You pray to them, you sacrifice to them so they don't. There was some famous demons in the ancient world that would come try to steal your children in the middle of the night. So you would pray to them, you would sacrifice to them. If you were a Mesopotamian, Egyptians did this too. You sacrificed to these demons so that they kept them away. They weren't pure evil. They were just like, they didn't play by the rules and they didn't care about ethics or morals. So they were unpredictable. They could help you or they could hurt you. So you just fed them and tried to make them go away and stay happy with you. That was how people dealt with them. Ancient Jews, ancient Israelites, they don't want you to worship like these, especially the folks who are responsible for the Bible. They don't want you to worship the demons. So they just don't mention them most of the time. The Old Testament doesn't have a whole lot about demons in it. The point is they don't want you to think about these things. They want you to try to become a monotheist, to think there's only one God. Problem is, when really bad things happen that break your idea about, like, God couldn't have done that. If there's only one power in the world, right, and that's a good power, then where does the evil come from? Once you get to a point in your nation's history or whatever, where if you're trying to become a monotheist, where something so big, this is the persecution of Antiochus IV, once there's someone persecuting your people, where is God in all this? So this is when the idea of the origin of evil as an embodied power, not just something in the hearts of people, right? The Old Testament wants to tell us, the book of Leviticus tells us, like, when you sacrifice, the sin is in your heart, and you've got to take responsibility for it. This stuff, by the time of the New Testament, yeah, you got to take responsibility for the sin in your heart, but there's also some other stuff out there. There's some evil spirits. There's more evil in the world than all the evil in human hearts added up together. Like, that's the kind of wager that's being made in this literature. So this is preparing the way for the New Testament, where demons are everywhere, right? So this is a very different thing than you see in the Old Testament. Elijah never casts out demons. Elisha never kills a demon. They don't ever do that. Isaiah never casts out a demon. Isaiah never mentions demons. Actually, he talks about goat demons once, but it seems to be kind of like a throwaway line where he's saying, don't worship these things. Don't care about them. Leviticus 17 says, don't talk about demons. Don't worry about these things. So all to say, the New Testament is very, very different. And here's where we can see some of this this stuff emerging. So we're reinterpreting the story of Job as not a story of God testing someone, but as a story of the devil fighting with someone. This is a very different way of thinking about how this story works. So when I heard this, I fell down. This is Job talking to his children on his deathbed. When I heard that this was like a temple to the devil, I fell down on my bed. I said, oh Lord, who's come to save my soul? Here's another new thing here. That is to say, your soul needs to be saved. If you read the Old Testament, you will never see someone say, I need God to save my soul, meaning like I need some sort of weight, like the book of sins to be kind of things canceled out so that my eternal soul can carry on in heaven. Like my debt needs to be paid so that God can carry on my soul in heaven so that I don't go to hell. You don't see this in the Old Testament. You see mentions of Sheol, but the place of the dead, but everyone seems to go there. There isn't a heaven mentioned in the Old Testament as a place that you're going to go and like be happy forever. There's the world of the dead where you can be happy dead or sad dead, but that's where you go. Your life is carried on through your children and through your progeny in the Old Testament. That's to say, they didn't yet have a notion of eternal life. This notion of eternal life and the everlasting soul, this is a Greek idea. Ancient Near Eastern people do not have this idea outside of Egypt. In Egypt, you have this notion of like this part of your body called the ba, the soul, we might say, that can kind of carry on. But we don't see this in Mesopotamia, and we don't see this in the Levant, in the Canaanites and the Israelites. They just don't talk about it in that way. When you see soul translated in the Old Testament into English, when you read soul, like in the Psalms, that word is nephesh, which means throat. It means your breath, the place where you live, like the seat of yourself and your whole body. But they didn't have a notion of your body being separate from a soul. Like there's an eternal soul in your body that's just going to march on forever after. That's a Greek idea. Not all Greek people believe in this, but it's an idea that you'll find in, like, say, some Greek literature. Like Plato, right? This idea that, like, you have this kind of everlasting soul that is separable from your physical body and that can carry on after you. So once Jews come in contact with these Greek ideas, probably first really in Alexandria, and it gets imported back, just like the Greek scriptures get imported back to Jerusalem and Judea, they start to kind of think in a different way. Wow, this makes a lot of sense. Hopefully the story of humanity doesn't end like when we die. Something carries on. But again, this is something that had to be introduced, like the notion of cosmic evil. They get introduced in like over a long period of time. This is part of my larger argument that God works slowly with people to help them where they are and help them kind of move, right? Learn, progress. In the same way that it took Christians about 300 years to come up with a pretty firm statement of who Jesus was. The New Testament says a lot of stuff about Jesus, but it doesn't say it all clearly all the time. But it takes Christians about 300 years to also come up with a statement about who God is. That is to say, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, how do these things relate to each other? Is Jesus fully God? Is Jesus fully human? Is the Holy Spirit part of Jesus or part of God the Father? Or is God the Father actually something separate from Jesus? Right. All of these are tricky questions that Christians didn't have a very clear way of answering for a long time. It takes a while to get some of these answers. And like I'm pointing out here, this notion of like an eternal soul, this is a new thing that comes about thousands of years after Moses. So, only 1,000 years after Moses. Okay, so, O Lord, who has come to save my soul. This notion of like my soul is something that can be saved and carried on for perpetuity. I beg you, if this is indeed the place of Satan, capital S, this is really talking about like the evil power, in which people are deceived, give me the authority. I'll go and purge this place so that we no longer make libations to him. It sounds a little bit like the story of Gideon from the book of Judges. But in Gideon, it's not an altar to the devil. It's an altar to Baal, a foreign god. So, and who here could prevent me since I rule this region? So Job is understood here as a king. He's not said to be a king in the book of Job, but he's called the greatest man in the East. So you got to be a king, right? So, man, it's kind of, again, interpreting a bit this other ancient text. From the light, so God is represented here as light, just light itself, another kind of little bit of a change here, came an answer. You will be able to purge this temple, but I will also show you other things that the Lord commanded me to relate you. Everything he commands to his servant, I answered, I will hear and do. And again, this angel, the light, God spoke, saying, thus says the Lord, if you try to purge and destroy the place of Satan, he will rise up in anger against you and do battle, although he will not be able to kill you. He will, however, inflict many plagues upon you and strip you of all your possessions and kill your children.
But if you endure, I will make your name renowned for all generations until the close of the age. I will also return your possessions to you twice over, so that you may know that the Lord shows no partiality, bestowing good things on everyone who is obedient. And at the resurrection, you will be raised up to become like an athlete who spars and endures many labors but receives the crown. You see a few changes here from ancient Israelite religion. One being the idea of being raised up, that you suffer here on earth so that you can be raised up later. Vicarious suffering is one way to think about this. Like, your suffering here in some way ensures your place in the world beyond. Old Testament doesn't say this. Your sufferings on earth might win you an eternal name. People remember your name because you did amazing things and you died in battle or something, right? That's one way that they would say it, that you live on by your sufferings. But here, the idea that there's this kind of like spiritual balance in a way, and like the things you do. Like, so we can think about this as people who endure great suffering on earth. If they think it's all for naught, they're probably not going to go through with it, right? So the idea of like endurance, this is a kind of a larger claim that God is actually going to make things right. This is part of a larger change within ancient Israelite religion, where there's also this kind of messianic age, the idea of a Messiah. Ancient Israelite religion, Messiah just means anything that's anointed. The menorah, the lampstand in the temple, that's a Messiah. It's an anointed thing. It's a Mashiach. Any priest is Mashiach, anointed with oil to make them a priest. Anything that's set aside to be holy has oil poured on it. It's Mashiach. That verb Mashiach just means to pour oil on something. Like, set it aside as holy by this ritual where you use oil, like Crisco, you know? I mean, so anything's a Messiah. Cyrus, the king of Persia, is called a Messiah in Isaiah chapter 45. He's the Messiah. Why? Because he's set aside by God to do a special task, to send the Israelite people home, the Judean people home, end the exile. So anyone's a Messiah. By this time, we start to have this idea that there will be a day when some amazing thing happens, inaugurated by God's special worker. A Messiah, understood at this time as a person, just a person, but a special person. Someone in the line of David, probably, who's going to come and set the world to right. And on that day, there will be a resurrection of the dead. There'll be kind of a great judgment, and there will be an eternal kingdom of righteousness. This is not something you find in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, there's like, God's going to fix things, but it's always here. It's always here and now. It's always an actual kingdom of flesh and blood, not something set in another time and place. We get this the only vision that's a little bit like this we get in the book of Daniel, near the end of the book of Daniel, chapter 12. It's very vague, very kind of spacey, almost literally spacey, like you become stars in the sky, you don't have a human body. But it's part of this progression. And that, of course, Daniel chapter 12, we think was written sometime around the year 164 BC, so during this Hellenistic era. Like an athlete who spars. No one in the Old Testament is called an athlete. Even Jacob, when he wrestles with God, is not called an athlete, primarily, whatever. This is not a metaphor that people are using in the Old Testament, because they didn't have athletic events in the Old Testament, really, right? Ancient Israel didn't have a lot of athletic competitions. They would fight with each other sometimes, but they didn't even have like jousting tournaments and things like that, right? You know, the idea of games and athletes, this is a Greek thing. The Greeks measure time in terms of Olympiads. That's how they actually take care of their time. Every 4 years, there's an Olympiad, right? They literally measure time in terms of Olympiads in ancient Greece. And they do in Canaan, too, right? In the area around Israel. In the Hellenistic era, they start to measure things in terms of Olympiads. Also, it becomes a big deal if you qualify for the Greek Games. There was a chariot driver from Phoenicia who qualified and actually won one of the Olympiads in Greece. And he became like the greatest hero in that region of the world, primarily because he proved that, like, we non-Greeks can do it, right? We can win. So this idea of athletes becomes a huge metaphor. Paul uses this as well. That is to say, some of these Greek traditions start to work their way into this literature. So Job continues with the story that we're jumping a lot here. For 48 years, I sat in a dung heap outside the city, played with the Jesus. We get a lot more specifics in this literature. 48 years, the book of Job doesn't tell us. It tells us that he sits for 7 days with his friends, but that's the only mention of time we have. We have no idea how long this thing takes. But 48 years I sat in the dung heap outside the city, plagued with diseases, until my children, with my own eyes, I saw my wife so humbled that she was bearing water as a slave to the house of some nobleman in order to obtain bread to bring to me. So here we get another aspect of this literature is at this time. This is, again, leading into what we would call Midrash. But we can see this in the New Testament as well, in early Christian interpretation. We get to start to see some more details. These characters that aren't fleshed out in the Old Testament, they start to get some more flesh, and they start to get some more story, backstory. Job's wife is a character in the book of Job chapter 1. She's mentioned a bit in chapter 2 as well. She kind of has her only speaking line in chapter 2, and then she kind of disappears from the rest of the story. So she's clearly a kind of a character that's playing a bit part, a kind of a role, right? You know, a role-playing character, right? That's just trying to kind of advance the story in some ways. Also, she's understood by many Jewish and Christian interpreters to be evil because she says, are you still holding on to your integrity? Bless God and die. She actually says, bless God and die. She doesn't say curse God and die, although it's translated curse in your Bible. In the book of Job, when the word bless is used, you actually never know whether it's bless or curse. This is the only book like this in the Old Testament. Like we say, bless your heart. I don't mean bless your heart when I say that, right? Often, right? You know. But this is not a common thing in ancient Israel. It's just in the book of Job. I think the book of Job is trying to get us to think about what are blessings and curses, but that's a lesson for another day. But all to say, Job's wife is actually saying three words that come from God and three words that come from the Satan. You're still holding on to your integrity. This is what God says. And then bless God and die. That's what the Satan says. So she's like kind of just showing Job what the kind of conflict in heaven is. She's often interpreted in a very negative way, probably because of misogyny, which is rampant in the Christian and Jewish tradition. But all to say, here we start to get this like more information about her. And she becomes actually a really sympathetic figure. That is to say that she goes out and finds bread. Job's dying, and he only stays alive because every day his wife goes out and works and does demeaning labor in order to earn bread to bring to Job. And she does this for 48 years. Shocked by what I saw, I said, oh, the arrogance of the city's magistrates, whom I consider unworthy of my pack of dogs. How can these my wife as a slave? So Job's mad about this, but he can't do anything about it anymore because he lost all his possessions and his power. But afterwards, I regained my composure and clarity of mind. After 11 years of her helping, right, so this is like, you know, 60 years she's been doing this, they even forbade her from bringing me bread, barely allowing her to have food for herself. But if she obtained any, she would divide it between herself and me, saying in her grief, woe is me. Soon he will not even have bread to eat. She'd not even shrink from going into the marketplace and begging bread from the bread sellers to bring me something to eat. That is to say, she sustains him. She's also given a name here, Sittis, or Sittidos. She doesn't have a name. She's anonymous in the book of Job. So all to say, you can actually find, like in the Christian tradition, there's lots of images where the devil and Job's wife are both attacking Job. Augustine says that Job's wife is the handmaiden of Satan. So she's often associated with Satan, like killing Job and so on. However, you can also find in the early Christian tradition, up through the Middle Ages, very positive images of Job's wife. Like here, this is from the catacombs in Rome. This is one of the earliest Christian paintings that exists. This is from the late 3rd century. This is from before the time of Constantine. And here we have Job positioned like a Greek philosopher who's sitting and contemplating, like a Stoic, contemplating his pain from like a distant position. Much more like the Testament of Job than like the book of Job where he's screaming at God all the time because he's mad, right? So here he's covered in sores and so on. And his wife is behind him holding on a stick a piece of bread. And it's shaped like the Eucharist. That is to say, she is styled as a priest, giving him the sustaining body of Christ from her own kind of flesh, right? She's the Christ figure here in a lot of these early Christian images. And this continues through the Middle Ages. Here's Job's wife from a Florentine codex in the 13th century. That is to say, this is late Middle Ages. And here's Job's wife with a halo, feeding Job with bread and wine. Wine's not mentioned in the Testament of Job, but here she's offering him the Eucharist. All to say, like, Job's wife, it becomes, in this kind of, it's not most pictures of her, it's a small minority, but this doesn't come from the book of Job, this comes from the Testament of Job. And other things, too, like this fascination with Job's daughters. Amazingly, in the book of Job, Job's daughters are named at the end of the book, and not his sons. His sons are never named, but his three daughters at the end of the book are named, and they're given these names of, like, beauty. Like cinnamon, and you know, one of them is like eyeshadow. The horn of Amalthea is the Greek translation of that, but I mean, it's like the horn that you would hold an eyeshadow in. That is to say, they're about kind of a Job remembers that the world is beautiful at the end of his story, and his daughters show that for him. Like they are kind of proof that the world is good and beautiful once again. He's kind of returned to the ability to appreciate life. But he also gives his daughters a share of the inheritance, which is not common in the ancient world, and is sort of set aside as kind of like another one of the things that Job's learned on his way, right? This is kind of at the end of the book of Job, the surprising thing that he devises inheritance with his daughters. This is William Blake's image of Job's daughters. But so they become a fascination just from the biblical book, but in the book of the Testament of Job, there's much more said about these daughters. They receive musical instruments.
And they play them, and they can speak in tongues. So there's this also tells us that in the late Greco-Roman period, right around the time of Jesus, that there's this notion that it's possible to speak in a heavenly tongue. This is a spiritual power given to some people. Paul talks about this, by the way, and the New Testament has to say this is not something that becomes a part of the rabbinic tradition, but it hangs out as a part of early Christianity and hangs on, and it was revived really in the Pentecostal period in the early 20th century with the Azusa Street Revival. But this idea that there's a spiritual power to speak in the language of angels starts to emerge in the Greco-Roman period. And Job's daughters are kind of imaged that way. They also get these magical sashes that can like heal people and do all this stuff. They become superheroes, really. This is kind of early superhero literature. But they also receive these musical instruments. And this is why Job became the patron saint of musicians throughout all the Middle Ages. And you'll see Job represented with musicians all the time, like in Christian art. This is Albrecht Dürer. This is Job, actually his wife, like, washing him, taking care of him. This is because Albrecht Dürer actually knew the story. The story is associated with the Testament of Job and has this very positive view of Job's wife because of it. Other medieval artists as well, and late early modern artists also were very familiar with these traditions. And here also, like, the kind of healing power of music. This is Albrecht Dürer himself. This is his self-portrait as a musician trying to soothe Job's suffering and so on. I'm not sure that Albrecht Dürer knew that there was such a thing as the Testament of Job. It had kind of... people had forgotten the name of that book, but these traditions were, had continued on. So all to say, this was a hugely influential book. And when James, the letter of James in chapter 5, verse 11, talks about the patience of Job, and that very famous phrase, the patience of Job, that's not talking about the biblical book because he is not patient in the biblical book. Almost all of the book is him screaming at God and saying he's upset. But Job, in the Testament of Job, is unbelievably patient and hangs on to the very end and fights against Satan and wins. This is the story that became very influential for the Christian tradition. So all to say that testamentary literature has been pretty important. I'm going to just fly through a little bit of this, but this is another one just to give you an example. The Testament of Moses. This is going to be our segue to Herod here. So there's a story that's actually, I think, quoted in Jude verse 9, and that is that there's a fight between the archangel Michael and Satan over Moses' dead body. If you've ever read the book of Jude, very short book, you can read it in 10 seconds. It's got some weird stuff in there, and it's referencing all this Second Temple literature that didn't make it into the Bible. Also, we can see that in Paul, at times, I think, is quoting from the Testament or the Assumption of Moses, or at least related traditions. Paul also quotes quite often from another testamentary literature called the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs. This is all of Jacob's children and like their deathbed speeches. But here in the Testament of Moses, the idea that like the Satan and the Archangel Michael are always fighting with each other. You can see that in sculptures all over the world and paintings and so on, right? This kind of eternal struggle. And we think that in part comes from here. So, Testament of Moses, I'm not going to read all this to you, but just to say you can kind of Google and read the Testament of Moses if you want, or sometimes called the Assumption of Moses because he's actually taken up into heaven after he gives this speech. It's like rereading Deuteronomy, but people got bored of reading Deuteronomy, so they made this kind of cooler, at least to them, literature. But one thing that happens is there's this like repetition of history, and it goes up to this one really interesting point in time. Let me read this. So chapter 6 of the Testament of Moses has this little bit. Moses is kind of telling history into the future. Like this is, you know, ancient, like this is understood to be an ancient book. It's really written in the Greco-Roman period. But Moses is here, it's like prophesying the future. They shall raise it to them. At one point, kings bearing rule, and they shall call themselves priests of Most High God. Ah, what kings called themselves the high priests? It was the Hasmoneans, right? The family of Judas Maccabeus and his descendants, which claimed the high priesthood and the kingship. So this is kind of like a talking about that point in time. They shall assuredly work iniquity in the Holy of Holies, so it's a bad thing. So whoever wrote this, they hate the Hasmoneans, right? And an insolent king shall succeed them. So someone's going to come after the Hasmoneans, a bad guy, who will not be of the race of the priests. Somebody who is not, at least fully, Jewish is going to become the high priest and king. A man bold and shameless, and he shall judge them as they shall deserve. So the people, this is claiming that the leadership, because the people supported this bad Hasmonean kings, this guy is going to be the punishment. A much even worse king. And he shall cut off the chief men with the sword. It's going to be a lot of people who he executes. And he shall destroy them in secret places so that no one may know where their bodies are. This guy's going to do a lot of dirty work. He shall slay the old and the young, even the innocents, we might say, and he shall not spare.
the fear of him shall be bitter unto them in their land. He shall execute judgments on them as the Egyptians once, like a long time ago, executed upon them. He's going to be bad like Pharaoh was bad. During 34 years, and he shall punish them. So this guy's going to reign for 34 years, and he's going to be bad. And he shall beget children, who succeeding him shall rule for shorter periods. They're going to break up the empire between them, the kingdom between them, and they're all going to have a little short king reigns. Into their parts, cohorts, and a powerful king of the west shall come. Somebody from the west is going to show up, who shall conquer them, and he shall take them captive and burn a part of their temple with fire, and shall crucify some around their colony. Anyone got a clue who we're talking about here?
Herod.
This is King Herod. So this is the, like, so again, this literature, we think, at least was written right around the time of King Herod.
Yeah. It seems to me this last detail of burning part of the temple means that it probably was after 70 AD.
Maybe. However, the temple was burned when Pompey invaded in 36 BC. So we're not exactly sure. Pompey, and later on, I mean, there were several like fights over the temple in the years leading up to Herod's reign. So there's it's complicated, in other words, yeah. But one thing, too, is that crucifixion was used for one of the Hasmonean kings. One of the Hasmonean kings ended up being crucified by Mark Antony. So all to say, like, it seems very clear it's 70 AD, and some people make that argument, but I don't know. It might be one of the other times, too. So if we just kind of, we'll come back to this in 2 weeks. We talk about the Romans, and we'll look at it from the Roman perspective. We'll look at it today from the Jewish perspective. So if we remember back to Alexandra Salome, who we talked about last time, right? The queen who was married to John Hyrcanus and managed to kind of hang on through Aristobulus and Alexander. I'm sorry, was married to Aristobulus, but managed to hang on through both Aristobulus' reign and his brother Alexander Janaeus' reign. And then she became queen in her own right. When she died in 67 BC, she handed off the reign to her son Aristobulus, but she had another son, Hyrcanus. Hyrcanus, you know, kind of after his grandfather, John Hyrcanus the first, so Hyrcanus the second, we call it. So Aristobulus, named after his grandfather Aristobulus the first. So these two brothers ended up fighting over the throne. They get into such a complex and long-lasting civil war. It basically goes from 67 all the way to 40 BC. So there's 20-some years of outright civil war between these two brothers. And at times, Aristobulus has the upper hand, and at times, Hyrcanus has the upper hand. These brothers, meanwhile, are being supplanted. All the while they're fighting, there is another family that doesn't come from Judea that has been working very hard to work their way into this system of power, and they've also been making great strides at becoming best friends with the Romans, the rising power from the west. This is the family of Antipater, who is an Idumean. He comes from Edom to the south. Now, during the time of John Hyrcanus, he conquers Edom and forces them all to become Jewish, forces them to circumcise and follow Jewish tradition. Remember, this is where I said, like, this is kind of strange because the Jews had been somewhat xenophobic for some time. You can't join Judaism. That was kind of unheard of in the early Hasmonean period, in the early Hellenistic period. But John Hyrcanus wants to expand his kingdom. He wants more Jews around. So he forces these people in Edom and in Samaria to become Jewish. Well, one of those families that becomes Jewish is Antipater. He's got a Greek and Roman name, Antipater. Antipas is another way of saying his name. So he loves Rome. He loves Greek culture and so on, and he has become very powerful within his realm of Edom. His father, I think, is the person who was forced to convert to Judaism. Antipater marries a Nabataean woman. The Nabataeans, if you've ever heard of Petra, a city in Jordan, right, with like carved into the rock. If you've ever seen Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, it's that place where the cup is held, right? The grail is held. But it's this city carved into rock in what is today Jordan. These were Arab peoples. The Nabataeans were an Arab people. They ended up becoming Christian by the Byzantine era. At this point in time, they were an earlier Nabataean, but an earlier version of Arabic, and worshiped local gods. So they were a people who lived nearby. They were great traders. They were very wealthy. They would trade from kind of spices and so on, things that people wanted from Arabia up into the Levant and to Phoenicia. So they were wealthy. Antipater marries a Nabataean woman. So he has a kid named Herod. So here's kind of the story here. Okay, so
Antipater, the Idumean, here's Idumea down here, way south of Jerusalem, and again, used to be a separate territory.
Kind of like historically aligned, right? So Jacob and Esau, these are the Esau people. So they're seen as like cousins of the Jews. And they are kind of sort of allowed to become Jews. Although we'll see that there is some, kind of ancient form of racism that always makes Herod suspect. Okay, so if we're going to get into the life of Antipater, the basic story is this. Antipater is the governor of Idumea. He becomes the governor of Idumea, and he becomes very close friends with the Romans. From a very early point on, he makes the wager. There's a world war going on between Greek kingdoms and the Romans, and he puts all his money on the Romans, that the Romans are going to succeed. They're going to beat the Greek rulers, like Cleopatra, of Egypt, and they're going to beat the Greek rulers, the Seleucids, in Syria. So he becomes very tight with the Romans, puts all his effort into making friends with them, first with Pompey, the Roman general, who is fighting against Caesar. So this was the triumvirate, the three leaders of Rome before the Civil War began, Crassus, who ends up losing pretty quickly on, and Pompey and Caesar. Pompey is a general, Caesar is a general. They both command these great forces in Rome. Caesar famously crosses the Rubicon with his army and basically declares war against Pompey. Caesar and Pompey start to fight. Pompey has risen to prominence in part because he basically takes over Judea. So, in the year 63 BC, these two brothers are fighting, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. And Hyrcanus appeals to Rome. He knows that Pompey's army is kind of in the region, appeals to Rome and says, please come here and settle this dispute with my brother. And of course, Pompey says, I would love to help you settle that dispute. So he sides with Hyrcanus. Aristobulus holds up in Jerusalem, and Pompey conquers Jerusalem, actually burns knocks down the walls, burns part of the temple in Jerusalem, walks into the temple himself. Pompey walks into the Holy of Holies, and he says, he tells people, I saw nothing, right? That is to say, there's no image of the God inside. But then leaves, and he ends up rebuilding Jerusalem and trying to give it to Hyrcanus. Meanwhile, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus are fighting over and over again for generations. But Antipater becomes great friends with Pompey. And because of his great alliance, he's allowed to place his son, named Herod, as the governor of Samaria. That is to say, the Romans want to subdue and occupy this area of Samaria. And Herod says, I'll do your job for you. He was 26 at the time. He goes, we think, either 26 or 27, or 28. He goes up to Samaria, and there was like apparently some lawlessness. We think it might have just been anti-Roman and maybe anti-Hasmonean revolt. So Herod goes there and puts down the revolt. Puts down the revolt so well, in fact, that he ends up being accused of war crimes. He has to come in front of the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem and appeal for mercy because he's being accused by... Now, maybe, I'm guessing, that some nobles in Jerusalem were worried about this family that was half Idumean and half Arab, half Nabataean, right? That's now going to like kind of take over Jerusalem. You know, like they're worried about this growing power that they see as... They're Jewish, sure, but not real, according to the people in Jerusalem, the nobles, not really Jewish. Does that make sense? Like, they're half convert, right? So this family of Antipater and Herod would have seen, it would have seemed like a rival, growing rival power that they would have to worry about. So they call Herod because of apparent war crimes down to Jerusalem. He stands before the Sanhedrin, and they are about to pass judgment on him, probably execution, when he flees to Rome. He runs away, gets in a boat, goes to Rome, and appeals to Rome for help. Rome says, well, we see there's a civil war basically happening. There's kind of chaos in Jerusalem and in the environs. What do you think we should do? Because his family, Herod's family, has been faithful to Rome for decades. Herod says, gosh, I really think that you should support Hyrcanus. Hyrcanus the second, he's probably the one who's more faithful to Rome. And the Roman Senate says, we got a better idea. How about you? Let's make you king. They declare him king over all Judea, Idumea, and Samaria. King of Israel, they call him. And they send him back. not with troops, just with the idea that he's now king. You do it yourself is kind of what they tell him, right? So he goes back, he raises up an army, he's got power bases in Samaria and Idumea, and basically he is now involved in a multi-year civil war where he's fighting both against Aristobulus and Hyrcanus. He used to be this guy's friend, and now he's got to kill this guy. He ends up just mutilating him so he can't become high priest anymore, and keeps him in a dungeon. This is the start of many of these stories with Herod. All right, I'll end in just a minute. Okay, so Aristobulus, meanwhile, is also involved in the civil war. Herod ends up gaining power over both of them. He's got Hyrcanus in a cage now. He ends up killing Aristobulus. And after a while, Herod the Great is able to marry Mariamne, the granddaughter of Hyrcanus. That is, he's marrying into the Hasmonean family. So Herod now has at least a foothold of a claim to be part of this family that, you know, has for a long time been kings and priests. But also some people are very upset. They're upset with him for a number of reasons. Number one, because they call him a half-Jew. And maybe even not that. That is to say, his dad was an Idumean convert and then had married someone who wasn't Jewish at all. And Herod is the son of that marriage. And this kind of, what we might call today, racist trope comes up again and again in Herod's life. That is, people keep coming back to the idea that he's not really one of us. He's half Jew. But he's married into this family. He's from this powerful family as well. So he's got some things in his favor as well. Herod ends up being an incredibly shrewd diplomat, especially with external policies. Eventually, Caesar beats Pompey, right? Meanwhile, the family, Antipater and also Herod, have made great friends with Caesar. Eventually, in the meantime, I had to deal with Mark Antony. We'll get to more of this story in 2 weeks. He's had to make friends with Mark Antony. When Caesar ends up dying, and then there's another civil war that emerges by Caesar's murder, there's another civil war that emerges, and, you know, remember, it's Mark Antony and Cleopatra against Octavian or Augustus Caesar, right? They both are claiming the throne. Well, Mark Antony and Cleopatra end up claiming Judah. And Mark Antony ends up even giving part of it to Cleopatra as a gift. So that is to say that Cleopatra and Mark Antony own this region. He's got to deal faithfully, that is, Herod has to deal faithfully with Mark Antony. When Octavius, later Augustus Caesar, wins the Battle of Actium, defeats Mark Antony and Cleopatra, unifies sort of the Roman Empire, takes control of that region, Herod imagines he's going to get killed, right? Because he's been a loyal, faithful ally of the enemy of Octavius Caesar for years. Well, Herod ends up going straight up to Octavius and says, "I have been incredibly loyal to Mark Antony, and you know I've even rescued." Literally, he shows up with an army and rescues Romans from time to time. So he says, "I've been incredibly loyal to your family." To the Roman leaders. My family's been incredibly loyal to many different Roman leaders, and I will be really loyal to you now. And Augustus is great and accepts, like, amazingly, doesn't execute him, accepts his appeal for aid, and then redoubles his support for Herod. We'll come back to, in 2 weeks from now, we'll come back to talking about the actual story of Herod from there on out and how he descends into madness and ends up executing almost all of his family, and also becomes probably the greatest king that Israel ever had in terms of building the prominence of Israel within the world and also in terms of building projects. He's the one who builds the temple and makes it a grand wonder of the world, according to Roman geographers. But he also builds Masada, this kind of amazing fortress in the middle of nowhere, and Herodium, a city of great... So he becomes the greatest builder that Israel ever had and also one of its greatest internal liabilities. So this great political instability that exists at the time of Jesus, but also the great prominence of Israel within the world, and especially Jerusalem, is all owed to Herod. So a great, complicated person that we'll delve more into in 2 weeks.
This podcast is a ministry of First Presbyterian Church of Marietta. Come join us Sundays at 189 Church Street, Marietta, Georgia, or visit us online at fpcmarietta.org.